Sorry about the vagueness with regards to the years. When you get to be 69, you stop counting. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of my wife as well, and to renew fellowship with many of you, and indeed to establish fellowship with others that we haven't already met. Now, this morning, as we take up this short account of the early days of the Baptists in Scotland, that's what we're going to think about. There are four main divisions. First of all, we'll look at something of the early beginnings and progress of the Baptist witness in Scotland. Then we'll look at some of the later departures and declensions. And following on from that, we'll take up the essential characteristics and features of those older Baptists, and then very briefly to conclude with a couple of the principles that come out of all of that. Now, I realize that there are places and names that will be unfamiliar to many of you, so I'll try and stop and pause as we go along and fill in at least some of the locations or some of the names. It should be of interest to us how God deals with his people in all generations and in all parts of the world. So although this is a very small part of the total witness of the gospel throughout the whole wide world, I trust it will be of some interest to each and every one of you. Now, whether or not there were any who held Baptistic views in the early days of the Reformation in Scotland, that's not all that easy to determine. Presbyterianism was in the ascendancy, which meant that toleration was at the minimum. John Knox had branded those who were then called Anabaptists as, quote, most horrible and absurd. And the Scottish Parliament had written to the Parliament in England with the demand that if they ever found any of these sects or schisms, then they would put them down. The fact that there should be such a demand from the Scottish Parliament would seem to indicate that there were, in those early days, those of a non-Presbyterian position, and in all likelihood, there would have been those who would have been of the Anabaptist persuasion that John Knox had denounced. As far as any organized church or group or movement of Baptists at that time, well, nothing really is recorded until the days of the Commonwealth. Those were the days of Oliver Cromwell. And when Cromwell's forces came north of the Tweed, as we would say, the River Tweed divides England from Scotland. When they came up from England into Scotland, then there were those who, of course, who brought their Baptistic convictions with them. Just exactly when the church, the first church, that was in a place called Leith, which was then just outside the old town of Edinburgh. Just when that church came into being, we're not sure. But in 1653, they republished the 1644 Confession of Faith, which was called the First London Confession. That was produced by those Cromwellian soldiers at that point. And the church then was composed of the soldiers of Cromwell's army. They were evangelistic, and it's very important to note that. And a contemporary diary from 1653 records that this year Anabaptists daily increased in our nation where never were any before. It tells about the additions that were made to the churches. And in fact, on 3 days of the week, on Friday and Wednesday and Monday, it says there were some dipped at Bunnington Mill. They were baptized. Bunnington Mill is a stretch of water outside the city of Edinburgh. Sometimes it says as many as 15 persons in one day were baptized by the Anabaptists. So the Cromwellian soldiers were apparently evangelistic, and they carried forward the work to that extent. When they left Scotland, of course, which was a cause of great rejoicing for the Scots, when they went south, there doesn't seem to be much after that departure of the Cromwellian soldiers until there were stirrings afresh in the hearts and minds of some or one or two inquiring souls. Now, the first name in the list of those local Baptist churches was a man by the name of Sir William Sinclair. He lived in Keith, which is the uttermost northern part of the land, the mainland. And it's perhaps somewhat out of keeping with the Baptists in Scotland and the national churches that were to be raised up that the first meetings were conducted in a castle. That was quite out of the ordinary. But Sir William Sinclair, of course, he was a knight. He lived in a castle, and the first church then was constituted in 1750 and met in the church of Sir William Sinclair. He probably came into Baptist convictions when he himself served in the army in the south. And as soon as he returned north again, he began to make those convictions widely known. He was dubbed as the preaching knight by the bishop of the diocese. That was the Episcopalian bishop. And he had many things to say about him. He accused them of, quote, having taken up that odd way of strolling about preaching without commission or appointment of any. He hadn't been ordained according to the Episcopal fashion. And this practice seems to have formed the basis of the charge, again, that he was a wrong-headed man, confessedly, by all who knew him, and that he vented the wildest and most extravagant notions that were ever hatched in the most disordered brain. The bishop didn't think much about Sir William Sinclair. Now, how extravagant those views were that he held, that's hard to say, but there was certainly nothing extravagant in the scriptural views that he held concerning the proper mode and the subjects for baptism, the proper observance of the Lord's table, or indeed the preparation of a little collection of Christian hymns, which would have been the first hymn book in the Protestant congregations in Scotland. So the church at Keith, that's away up in the north of Scotland, under the pastoral care of Sir William Sinclair, it came into being, numbered about 30 at the time of his removal down to Edinburgh, and he died there in 1768. He was succeeded to the pastoral charge by a man called John Budge, and that took place in 1763. That's a very notable year as far as the churches that would be called Baptist in Scotland are concerned. As that old founder, Sir William Sinclair, moved down south, there were two other men in the country, one called Robert Carmichael and the other one called Archibald MacLean. And Robert Carmichael asked a question of Archibald MacLean. He said, "What do you think of baptism?" And the result of those inquiries by both of those men to that question came the eventual founding of a grouping of churches which were to be known as the Scotch Baptists. It was part of the whole Baptist movement, but they would be known as the Scotch Baptists. Both Archibald MacLean and Robert Carmichael were members of the Glassite movement, and that had created a great deal of rumblings and divisions within the National Presbyterian Church of Scotland. John Glass, from which the movement took his name, had been a Presbyterian minister of the Church of Scotland, but he was deposed from his living in 1730 on account of his views of the church being separate from the state and independent from the state. He believed that Christ's kingdom is purely spiritual and a national church is unwarranted under the New Testament. He also held that any society or church of believers is self-ruling. And it was views such as these that Robert Carmichael and Archibald MacLean had already established in their hearts and their minds. And then, of course, when the conversation concerning baptism arose, it was really a follow-on from those views that they had taken up out of the writings of John Glass. Eventually then, on October the 9th in 1765, Robert Carmichael went south to London and was baptized in the baptistry of the well-known Dr. John Gill, that was in the meeting house in the Barbican in London. On his return to Edinburgh then, he baptized Archibald MacLean, and two churches sprang up, one in Edinburgh and one in Glasgow. Although MacLean was the second of the two brethren in question to be baptized, it was his influence that was to dominate and be uppermost among the Scotch Baptists that were to follow on. He was known affectionately as Father MacLean. He was a printer by profession, and he used the business under his control to good advantage, produced many good pamphlets on baptism and other subjects that we would hold dear to our hearts. Charles Haddon Spurgeon called this commentary in Hebrews, he wrote a commentary in Hebrews, one of the most judicious and solid expositions ever written. John Brown, who wrote the momentous commentary on 1 Peter, confesses that he derived much advantage from the writings of Archibald MacLean. And the saintly Robert Hall pronounced that he was a man mighty in the Scriptures. Such was the founding fathers of the Scotch Baptists of the mid-18th century. Now, what were the Scotch Baptists? As far as their doctrinal position went, Scotch Baptists were in absolute accord with all the Baptist churches that came into being and existed up until the middle of the 19th century. That is, they were Calvinistic and held to the doctrine of God's free grace in the salvation of sinners. It was in the issue of church order that they differed from some of the other groups. One of the strongest tenets of the Scotch Baptist system was the plurality of elders, or the plurality of pastors, within each local church. These elders or pastors were men normally engaged in a daily job of work, but who took the oversight of the church between them outside their regular working hours. On the other side, the other main grouping were called English Baptists. Now, these English Baptists were not called by that name because they were composed of English men and women, or even because they had English pastors, but because their pastors were set aside in a full-time capacity in line with the churches, the Baptist churches in England. There came a point where the Scotch Baptists began to set some men aside full-time as well, but that was not for preaching. It was for pastoral care and visitation and these other items. But that was the Scotch Baptist view. Alongside of their view of the ministry were several other distinctives, and I'll just list these out of one of the histories. The breaking of bread took place every Lord's Day and was for baptized believers alone, and of those only such as held the same principles of order and faith. The prayers and exhortation of the brethren in the public meetings, the fellowship or contribution for the poorer brethren, the agape or love feast, were all scriptural institutions to be observed. Minor observances held as obligatory were sustained with a sober judgment. The kiss of charity and the washing of feet reserved for special occasions were not regarded as religious institutes. It was the duty of a Christian to marry only in the Lord, and submission to the civil power in all things lawful were prescribed. So those were the Scotch Baptists brought into being under the providence of God through those early remarks and conversations between the two men, Robert Carmichael and Archibald MacLean. That was in 1763. And in spite of some setbacks and dissensions, there were about a dozen churches by the end of the century, and they were making good, steady progress. Now, during those years of the 1760s, when MacLean and Carmichael began to take up their Baptist position, two brothers were born into an aristocratic Perthshire family. Their names stand forever linked with the Baptist witness in Scotland. They were the Haldane brothers, Robert Haldane, who was born in 1764, and James, his brother, who was born 4 years later. Just as the Scotch Baptists had their antecedents in that which wasn't Baptist, that is the Glassite movement, you remember, so the English Baptists, the mainstream Baptists, in fact, they also came into being through the Haldane movement, which wasn't distinctly Baptist at the beginning. The Haldane members were members of the Church of Scotland, which at that time in the 18th century was almost completely dominated by moderatism. The moderates, we're told, were those who, having chosen their names, taught a gospel without grace and set forth salvation by works. And this is a lovely piece of description. They preached salvation by works, but left the performance of the works to others. Pretty typical. It says their religion was certainly not deeply felt, and the moderates have in recent times been described as modest men. They were men of wide culture and good breeding and could enter into debate with the educated of their day. Unfortunately, their culture was not the authentic culture of Calvary. The Haldanes were both converted, and in 1797, James Haldane preached his first sermon, and the die was cast for many, many years of work that lay before the two of them. Now, two aspects of the Haldane's work that you have to take note of were the establishing of buildings that were called preaching tabernacles. They were in the major cities. And also the formation of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel at Home. Through the latter, the propagation of the gospel, the work was carried to the far-flung reaches of Scotland. And out of both of the branches of the Haldane's work, Baptist churches then were to emerge and grow until in the year 1808, the Haldanes themselves came to an acceptance of believers' baptism. Now, one case in particular links up the two things. As I say, they went forward propagating the gospel, and again, I'm quoting from one of the historical accounts. About the beginning of the 19th century, Mr. James Haldane of Edinburgh preached in the Grantown district. Now, that's a district in Scotland, about 30 or 40 miles from Inverness. Through the influence and liberality of the Haldanes and others, several missionaries itinerated at intervals in the country, and their efforts resulted in the formation of an independent church at Rothie Mercosats, again, not all that far from ourselves. These are areas from Strathspey and Badenoch. The Christians met in this church with Lachlan McIntosh as their leader. He was a man of outstanding gifts and character, so that for years he continued to preach and administer the ordinances as an independent Paedobaptist, largely supported by the Haldanes. Through study, he began to see the truth of believers' baptism, and being an honest man, he felt he must see Mr. Haldane on this matter. He therefore walked all the way to Edinburgh. That would have been about 165, 170 miles. Walked the whole way to Edinburgh, trusting that he would find his new views overthrown by the greater experience of Mr. Haldane. But the result of a long conversation was exactly the opposite. Mr. Haldane was absolutely shaken in his views, and Mr. McIntosh was confirmed in his, so that he was baptized in Bristol Place Church before returning north, and shortly after this interview, Mr. Haldane was also baptized. Haven't we seen the same thing often enough? Now, if you stay with that church then in Granton-on-Spey was the whole area, but also the name of the main town. You have an example of the kind of thing that took place. As we're told, Lachlan McIntosh returned north, and then he began to resign from the church. He found that it wasn't honest to continue in this independent church now that he had taken on baptism. But as it turned out, the bulk of the congregation had also taken on the view of believers' baptism, and the church was reformed then in the Baptist fashion and according to Baptist principles. Sometime later, Lachlan McIntosh, that was the church at Rothy Mercus, sometime later he came into the town of Granton and Spey, says he was offered a room in a house to conduct some meetings, but it wasn't long before he was being cried down as a heretic by the local clergy. The laird, that's the man who owned the landmass, the laird also issued a statement forbidding him and his Baptist to preach or to meet in any house on his estate. The church then went and gathered at an old gravel pit. It was very limited cover, and especially in the Scottish winters, but they conducted the worship of God in that place. A young man by the name of Peter Grant came to one of those services one day, and he was appointed the pastor of the church eventually, and in fact pastored for 41 years in the church in Granton and Spey. During Peter Grant's ministry, the work grew till there were about 300 who were able to meet in those premises. And eventually there was a softening on the part of the laird. He gave permission for a church to be built, and they built, well, a church building to be built. The church was already there, of course, even though it was in the gravel pit. But a church building was built, and the work then progressed. Now, that kind of thing was happening in many, many other places. The tabernacles had been built. The preaching was going forth through the society of the propagation of the gospel. The word was being spread. And it went way up into the Orkney Islands. Keese, where Sir William Sinclair was the northernmost part of the land. But then beyond that, there's a cluster of islands that are called the Orkney Islands. And the Haldians went way up there and preached, and churches were formed, and the Lord was glorified. So by the middle of the 19th century, the 1850s, there were an estimated 90 Baptist churches in Scotland, with a total membership of 6,000. Though the Scotch Baptists and the English Baptists differed on some points of church order and government, both arms of the movement continued in the doctrinal truths of the London Confession, which had been republished there at Leith in 1653. Changes were to come, of course, and the second half of the century was to witness a departure from the position that had been held for all of those years previous, and a time of decline then entered in. Now, you'll know one of these anomalies. When you speak about the decline of the Baptist witness in Scotland from the latter part of the 19th century onwards, some would object to that. For although there had been numerical losses from some of the churches for various reasons, the membership of churches, in fact, had increased in many, many ways. But as we all know, declension isn't something that we interpret through numbers or anything else, but through a spirit and through the lack of the Spirit of God and the departure from the great truths of the gospel. And although it can be difficult to determine the real first causes in a church or a group departing from the truths of the gospel, there are usually some steps that are traceable and discernible. Now, one of the significant factors which brought a change of face to the Scottish Baptist scene was the necessity for immigration. When you consider a church like the one at Granton and Spey, the building was erected to hold a congregation of 500. That was almost decimated to an unworkable number. The main cause for that really was immigration. They were very hard days in Scotland. The lairds, those who owned the lands, had driven the people off the land in order to establish sheep farms. Many of them, of course, emigrated to this part of the world, the New World, as it was then called. There was hardship in many places, and nowhere more so than in the Highlands of Scotland, and Grantonance Bay, of course, is part of the Highlands. Now, there was that. That was a factor, at least numerically. But around this time, there began to be a great troubling in many of the churches over the appearance of Plymouth Brethrenism. As Brethren assemblies began to rise up in many areas, so a good many of the Baptists moved their allegiances and united with them. The new teaching of dispensationalism was an attraction to some, and the Baptist view of the ministry, the Scotch Baptist view of the ministry, of course, was very akin to that which was being propagated by the Plymouth Brethren. Now, the threat to the distinctive Baptist witness, however, and again, this is something we know well enough, it didn't come from those who moved out of the Baptist churches over to Brethrenism, but from those who had embraced those views and remained within the churches. And so the whole face of the belief and practice of the Baptist churches began to change. Whereas the older Calvinistic Baptists, well, they would have seen things clearly and would have acted in the way that they should. The new style of Baptists were submerged by the attractions of the dispensational movement. Now, a few of the older Baptists, though not distinctly Calvinistic, they also ended their days in dispensationalism. I'll just give you one example of that. And there's a man called Dougal Sinclair, had ministered for many years in a place called Loch Gilphead in Argyllshire. And then it says, unfortunately, in his later years, he imbibed peculiar views on prophecy. He believed that Europe was to be involved in a universal war, with Britain at its center. America was to be accepted, and it was there that the Church of Christ was to be preserved till his return. Having such firm convictions, he prepared to emigrate, and such were his influence throughout the district that about 70 members with their families accompanied him to what they regarded as the Promised Land. So you live in the Promised Land, in case you didn't know. So tendencies were abroad, you see, that were proving to have an adverse effect on the peculiar standing of the whole Baptist faith and order. But probably the biggest single factor in bringing about a whole change of outlook among the Baptists was to be found in the type of men who then established the Baptist Union. That was in the year, that was the Union of Baptist Churches, in the year 1869. There had been attempts at sisterhood church level. The Haldanes had stood apart from that. They were very firm in the independent nature of each local church. But these men who then began to form the Baptist Union were of a different ilk than those of the earlier Baptists. The one thing that knitted these men together, apart from their desire for a union, was that the fact that they had come to embrace what was called the Morrisonian doctrine of the atonement. John Morrison was a Presbyterian minister in a place called Kilmarnock, and when he began to preach a potential universalism in opposition to particular redemption, then he drew many after him, and among them were these leaders of the Baptist Union in Scotland. Now, how some other men of widely different views from that were able to accommodate their beliefs and practices with this new spectrum of Baptist life, well, that's impossible to say, as it is today in the same kind of situations. Perhaps it was the desire for consolidation, the view that there was strength in numbers and power in numbers. Whatever, the outcome was assured on such an uneven footing. You can't really hold these two things in concert. And so the whole movement then took a new direction. By the end of the 19th century, the 1800s, the strains of liberal theology were being sounded out from the Baptist pulpits in many, many places. And at the presidential address of the assembly, then there was an invitation given to throw over all the vestiges of the things that had been most surely believed among them. In that year, another example, a man called George Coates, one of the New Style Baptists, prepared a pamphlet, and in this he advocates kneeling in prayer, responses, chanting of hymns and psalms, robed choirs. Some of the suggestions were introduced into his own church. By the 1930s, modernism was in full gallop. There were cases of Unitarianism, a denial of the triune Godhead. And an attempt was made in the 1940s to try and consolidate things back again onto an even keel. But even up to this day, there is all the influences that had begun to be introduced by the Union and through the men who first formed it. So that at the present day, there is ecumenism, that's widespread. The charismatic, of course, is very much to the fore. And the churches, all these various views have received an accepted niche within the church's thinking. So the general position, doctrinally, you would say the Baptist churches on the whole are Arminian. I'm not sure even if you could say that, if they even have a defined doctrine of Arminianism. They're doctrinaless would be probably the best way to put it. Theologically indifferent. Doesn't matter what you hold. When I left the Baptist College, I was given the counsel, as were the others, that you preached about what everybody believed, and you preached about 20 minutes. That was the counsel that was given. Neo-evangelicalism would probably be the uppermost position, but modernism, in all the worst of its forms, they are there. Entertainment, of course, is at its height. The robed choirs that George Coates advocated never really took on to the Scottish spirit, but the whole concept of entertaining in order to evangelize, that's in full swing. We've got the charismatics, as I've said. We've got dance and drama, the ecumenical question. All of these things are with us to this time, this day. So these elements of Baptist union life in Scotland, now they're intended to be read as the general. There are many, many dear souls in the Baptist churches. There are Baptist churches, in fact, which would put to shame some of the other denominations in many, many ways. But as far as the historic characteristic of the older Baptists are concerned, then there's been an almost total drift and a reversal of those things which the older believers once accepted. Now, what about the essential characteristics and features? I better have a look at this watch. Right. Now, with regards to those, you could say that the essential leading features of the older Baptists were three. They believed that salvation was by grace, that worship was to God, and that the gospel was for sinners. In the matter of salvation, the early Baptists to a man were believers and upholders of the truth that salvation is of God. In a word, they were Calvinistic in their understanding of the gospel of God's grace to sinners. When Robert Carmichael asked Archibald MacLean at that time, "What do you think of baptism?" he didn't have to ask him what he thought of the gospel or what he thought of the sovereignty of God in the work of the gospel. In fact, Archibald MacLean, as I said, had a printing works in Glasgow. One of the works that he produced was that of the great Puritan John Owen. And a glance at any of the articles of faith of the old Baptist churches shows that their commitments to the doctrines of the gospel, as we would have them, were total. Now, regarding that, just one example from the particular Baptist church in Glasgow regarding election. God, from all eternity, to glorify his own free grace and mercy, holiness and truth, elected part of mankind in his own Son to be partakers of grace here and glory hereafter. With regards to effectual calling, all that in the councils of peace were given to Jesus and redeemed by him are in due time by the ministry of the Word and the Spirit convinced of their sinfulness and obnoxiousness to God's wrath and are enlightened in the knowledge of Jesus as the only Savior. Now, articles like that would be difficult to find in the Baptist churches today, except where they would be held perhaps as museum pieces in accordance with the trust deeds of some of the churches. The same convictions with regards to the doctrine of salvation that lay behind the whole work of the Haldanes, both at home in Scotland and over into the continent of Europe, where Robert Haldane, of course, mightily ministered and brought about a revival of the truth of the gospel there. And some of Haldane's emphases are stated like this. One, it gave a prominent emphasis to the necessity of a personal knowledge and experience of grace. Two, it maintained the absolute authority and divine inspiration of the Bible. Three, it was a return to Calvinistic doctrine against Pelagianism and Arminianism. Robert Haldane himself assures us of his intention, writing about the students that he ministered to in Geneva. He says, as far as I was enabled, I endeavored to lay open to them the rich stores of religious instruction contained in the Epistle to the Romans. In studying this epistle, I turned their attention to the great doctrines of the gospel, so successfully revived at the Reformation by Luther and his associates, as well as by Calvin, with whose writings, though the founder of their church, these were Presbyterian churches, they had no acquaintance. I did not attempt, however, to make them disciples of Calvin or of any other man, but to bring them to be followers of Christ, to sit at the foot of his cross, and to learn of him who spake as never man spake. Way up beyond the Orkney Islands, you have the northernmost part of Caithness, then you have the Orkney Islands, then you have another group of islands called the Shetlands. In fact, they're nearer to Norway than they are to Scotland. I don't know how we got claim to them, but we happened to have them. There was a man there called Sinclair Thompson. He came to Baptistic position, had never heard in his life that there were such a people as Baptists. But when he read the Word of God, it became clear to him that this matter of baptism was much water and believers only. He made some attempts to go down to Edinburgh to receive baptism at the hands of others, but the weather can be very, very treacherous up in that part of the world. He never, ever reached Edinburgh, but in the providence of God, a Baptist minister came from Edinburgh on holiday to Shetland. Sinclair Thompson expressed where he stood, and he was baptized at the hands of this visiting preacher. Now, for 48 years, Sinclair Thompson was to minister in ceaseless toil around the Shetlands. He established many, many churches. He preached, they reckon, about 6,000 sermons in his travels. He was known as the Shetland Apostle, and he died in the 80th year, a non-apologetic Calvinist right to the end. In asserting that salvation is God's work, he told his hearers, a careful perusal of the first chapter to the Ephesians will show the origin of all the real conversions that have taken place or ever shall take place upon the earth. Sinclair Thompson, like all of his breed, believed that there was one gospel and one gospel only. The statistics would bear this out, for in the early 19th century, there was only one non-Calvinistic Baptist church, and it was Unitarian, in fact. All the Baptists at that time were believers in the doctrines of grace, the doctrine of salvation. Now, this determined the kind of worship that was then followed in the churches. The actual form of worship followed by the early Baptists in Scotland was a direct consequence of the things most surely believed amongst them. We've seen that it was only towards the end of the 19th century that the Arminianism that revolves around the free will and ability of man, that began to make a profound difference on the worship of the churches, because what a person holds with regards to the gospel will determine how they worship the God of the gospel. And so the older churches, and again, just to give an example, out of the articles of faith of that church in Glasgow that I mentioned earlier, those who are of one faith, it says, and have the same view of the ordinances, are bound to meet together for God's glory, for their own edification, and if God bless his own appointments, for the conversion of sinners. Now, if you study that order well, they are to meet together first for the glory of God, second for the edification of believers, thirdly for the conversion of sinners, and that, as it says, only if God blesses his own appointments. In other words, as we follow out the directives with regards to the worship of God, the old Baptists knew, as Paul would say, that a man is not crowned except he strive lawfully, except he runs according to the rules of the game. And a sidelight on the earlier practice of the Scotch Baptists speaks volumes with regards to their attitude towards the things of the Lord and as they employed those things in the worship of God. In those earlier days, when the people were obliged to learn a new tune by simply singing it over again, it was considered inappropriate to sing the actual words of the psalm or the hymn in question. They were only learning a tune, and it was inappropriate then to sing the actual words of the psalm or the hymn. So they would, bone up on some piece of natural theology. They would sing words like this: "The moon has but a borrowed light, a faint and feeble ray. She owes her beauty to the night and hides herself by day." See, they needed a tune, but they wouldn't sing the words of the hymn or the psalm. That was for the worship of God. And so they would sing those kind of lines. Same principle spread themselves across the whole broad spectrum of Christian thinking. You get an account of an induction service and how it's carried out. There was the preaching, the praying, the singing of God's praise, the laying on of hands, the appointment of the pastor in question. And when all of that's laid out and sent to the other churches, it says, "On this form I shall add no reflections. I hope it will commend itself to every enlightened soul." You see, if you all believe that we meet together for the glory of God and for the edification of the believers and for the conversion of sinners, if God blesses his own appointments, then these things should commend themselves to every enlightened soul. The Baptists knew that man's chief end is to glorify God, and nowhere was God to be more glorified than when the church met together in the worship of his name. The church had a man-word calling that was to sinners, but it had the God-word calling, and they had a total commitment to the souls of the unconverted, but they never lost sight of a total commitment to the honor of God, to whom they endeavored to bring the unconverted through the grace of God in the gospel. When that spirit of evangelism then was abroad, then God was glorified. That society for the propagation of the gospel at home that came into being through the Haldanes, In fact, prior to that, Archibald MacLean delivered a fervent address in which he endeavored to show the people of God in Scotland their great obligation to others in having been made the objects of God's grace. In comparing our situation with theirs, he says, the unconverted, those at the to the uttermost parts of the world, in comparing our situation with theirs, we cannot but adore the sovereign dispensations of God and his distinguishing grace towards us who were originally in the same state and deserved no better than they. And then he moves on, having acknowledged God's grace towards us, if it be our duty to pray that his kingdom may come, that his saving health may be known among all the nations, and for this end he would send forth laborers into his harvest, it must undoubtedly be our duty to act suitably to such prayers and in so far as we have it in our powers. In other words, we just don't pray that God's kingdom will come, but under the grace of God, we go forth to endeavor to see the kingdom come. And the gospel labors of the Haldanes at home and abroad were virtually unceasing. They sacrificed much. The wealth that God had given to them, they used liberally for the spread of the gospel. It wasn't easy. Things are never easy. And the biographer of the Haldanes says that 20 checkered years of failure and success had not dampened the youthful ardor with which the two brothers had devoted their lives to the spread of the gospel. When Robert Haldane went to Geneva, says the name of Robert Haldane stands inseparably connected with the dawn of the revival of the gospel of the continent of Europe. His memory is embalmed in our hearts and is hallowed amongst us. Peter Grant, the man who went to the church in Granton and Spey, he was a Gaelic speaker. Gaelic is the native language, especially of the Highlands. He wrote a collection of Gaelic hymns, and even to this day, it's said that when there's been a time of reviving, then the hymns of Peter Grant have been very much to the fore. He gives us an indication of what the state of things were like. He says, at marriages and christenings, drinking and dancing, shooting and swearing was usual. At funerals, drunkenness and fighting were so fashionable, shall we say, that one would cast up to the other, there was no fight at your father's funeral. You see, there wasn't an abundance of whiskey to fire up the spirits. And that was the general state of things. And in one of his hymns, Peter Grant's hymns, he sings, let pity unto us be shown by those who have God's grace before the hour of death shall come to take us from this place. In other words, while it is yet called today, let us work in the gospel. Many other names, Christopher Anderson, who was one of the English Baptists, he was part of the Edinburgh Bible Society. He was one of the men instrumental in translating the Bible into the Gaelic language. And he relates his visit to the islands, and he says, dark as midnight. That was the state of things. As to the people's knowledge of God, our Savior, and the means of instruction, oh, destitute and dark as midnight. To such questions, can you read? Have you a Bible? Do you go to the kirk, to the church? Can your father and mother read? Do you know anyone who can read to you? In many instances, to most, and in some cases, all of these questions, the answer was, no, sir. It was spiritual blackness for the simple reason that the Word of God was set aside and didn't even exist in the language of the Gaelic-speaking people. And it's a sobering statement that the Red Indians of New England had the complete Bible in their own language by the labors of John Eliot more than 100 years before the Scottish Gaels had even the New Testament. That was the state of things, and only eternity itself will reveal the debt that the Highlands owe to the labors of men, such as Christopher Anderson, who was the founder of the Gaelic School Society and many other things. But these were the Baptists in Scotland in those early days with regards to the Bible and the biblical things they believed and practiced. They didn't originate anything. They simply, by the grace of God, rediscovered what was there in the Word of God all alone. Not only did they come to know the truth that they had received to their own hearts, but they desired to carry the truth to others so that God might be worshipped and glorified all the more. And the principles then, those ones that I mentioned, uppermost, the worship of God, well, salvation by grace, I think, was the first I mentioned. That statement of Sinclair Thompson, careful perusal of the first chapter of the Ephesians, will show the origin of all the real conversions that have taken place or ever shall take place upon the earth. And I'm sure I don't have to remind you of that, that in the grace and mercy of God, he predestinated us according to the glory of his name. It's all to the glory of his name. The other, that what was done was for the worship of the Lord our God in heaven above. And as Paul writes to Timothy, I'm writing these things to you, he says, in order that you might know how you ought to behave yourself in the house of God, the church of the living God, the pillar and the bulwark of the truth. And with regards to the going forth of the gospel, then even in the worship and certainly in the evangelism, all things were according to God's appointment. It is for God's glory, our own edification, and if God bless his own appointments, for the conversion of sinners. So such were the Baptists, and as I say, perhaps names strange and unknown, but we trust perhaps a little will have rubbed off, and we'll pray for a resurgence of what the Baptists in Scotland once believed, and that the Lord would graciously give an outpouring of those things into many hearts once again.